Well, thank you very much, Robin, for coming back into the ABC after having left for a little while and after being here for 35 years. Can you just give me a very brief potted history of
your time
here?
Thank you very much. And of course, it's probably impossible for me to really, you know, survey those 35 years, but I arrived as a young poet really into the ABC, and I worked on a landmark program in radio called Late Line, which was the first program to bring together people in other countries by satellite using the technology. So I honed my interview skills there, and I worked then on a couple of rather wonderful programs, one called Broadband, which was a sort of multi-departmental extravaganza that eventually folded and became two programs called Double Take, which I really enjoyed and began working at my feature ideas and skills. I was a founding producer on Background Briefing, so I made a certain kind of more straight up and down, you know, topical and investigative type feature. Going on to be a member of the arts unit that formed in 1984, where I made for a couple of years programs under the name Half Hour Features called Point Taken. And then merged with colleagues into a riotous program, experimental program called Surface Tension, 1986 to 19, we ended at the beginning of 1988. This was a brilliant Saturday afternoon program that was wildly experimental, had two hosts that spoke, and we used a lot of sound and a lot of voices. And in fact, I can remember a certain gentleman, a sound engineer, who begged not to be assigned to putting that program to air because it was so stressful and it really was, you know, difficult. We were juggling a lot of elements, and that was a great time for learning new things that I was able to then take into the listening room, which was on air from 1988 to the end of 2003.
Just before we move on to the listening room, so tell me a bit more about Surface Tension. What were kind of some of the kind of wild things that you did?
What were the wild things we did? We'd pick, there were a group of us working on it. Tony McGregor, Virginia Madsen, for a while Paul Charlier, who's a theatre sound designer and composer, theatre composer, myself, Martin Harrison, Andrew McLennan, of course, worked on this program. And we would take topics in a way, which is where we approach things very laterally. We would each make something that might contribute to this overall theme, whether it might be telematics or very simply gone fishing. I can remember Tony McGregor and I working on the fishing program, and he was very interested in the, you know, outdoor sport of fishing and what it entailed. And I was very interested in artwork that was inspired by the sea. So we were able to bring our elements into an overall mix. Even if we made a feature that was quite a finished work in itself, it would still just slide into the mix without necessarily any special introduction and ending. So we were really interested in the experience of listening.
And the kind of experience of listening you were trying to create?
Well, we were trying to, we saw ourselves very much as an alternative to what people might otherwise be doing on a Saturday afternoon. So we were trying to create an animated, rich, sensuous experience of listening to the radio, to more cultural material, but not dished up in a sort of classic, staid, high cultural way. We were madly adventurous and really, it's a program that ought to be looked at again by someone.
Mm. And then you moved on, or the program also kind of folded into the listening room.
Yes.
What was the listening room?
The listening room, well, for a start, I think we were occupying too much mainstream space there with Surface Tension and creating too much havoc, because a lot of listeners, some really enjoyed it, but of course older listeners were perplexed by the kind of radio we were making. So we were given a very generous offer to merge with another colleague in drama, Roz Chaney, who'd been doing a lovely series called Images, a stereo set of programs on what was, you know, what has become Classic FM, was ABC FM. We merged with Roz, and the idea of bringing together Images with the kind of work we'd been doing in Surface Tension and wanting to work with composers and various other artists, and to see what work they might make on the radio. So we were given a later evening time slot, which was considered more appropriate for experimental work, I suppose. But we were nevertheless allowed to design our own program and to see what would come of merging the stereophonic images approach of feature making with our own eclectic style.
Let's talk about your feature and documentary making. Can you give us an idea of what your philosophy of feature making is?
Really, what I've been working towards is a way of presenting things that I might have thought reasonably deeply about in a way that is hopefully seductive at first. My intention is really to take people where I can on a journey through experience into ideas. Now, I work for a public broadcaster, so they're not always my own ideas. They're not always things that I want to make programs about. But where I can, and I suppose those works that are signature works where you can really hear my hand or my touch, is something that's always going to bring together the notions of writing, of distilling things down to an essence, of engaging the ear by employing music, sound, and compelling verbal imagery, and certain tones of voice, not necessarily in mine, but in the people I might have spoken to take people very quickly into a world where they're taken, I hope, on a bit of a journey through ideas that they don't want to walk away from. So the ideas I've been interested in addressing range from seemingly simple things like shoes. You know, everybody wears shoes, so it's something that everyone can relate to, but it will take people on a journey through history from, you know, the Egyptian conception of footwear, not just footwear, but how we connect our foot ourselves to the earth, how we walk on the earth, what it means to be shoeless and homeless, what it means to be in a fairy tale, what it means to be a forensic investigator of crimes where shoes matter. I'm sure that's a program that came to me probably. I find there's a very long boil with ideas, so that would have been something that initially came to me as a child, thinking about fairy tales, some of those graphic Grimm's fairy tales, because I have a very vivid imagination. And over time, you know, just the distilling of ideas plus things that are fun, but finding a way into something that's really quite deep. The deeper thoughts probably have been about nationalism, identity, that are expressed in programs such as The Raft of the Medusa or On the Raft All at Sea.
Which people can hear on the website.
And they have, you know, I have thought long and hard because of my background as somebody who is, you know, Croatian and Australian through heritage. I've thought a lot about what it means to have an identity, what it means to be in another space, in somebody else's world, what it means when the fragile bonds between us are ruptured and what is unleashed when that happens.
Mm. You used in two programs the painting by Jericho, The Raft of the Medusa. What is it about that painting that seems to represent so much for you?
Well, for a start, I studied what was called fine arts or art history at university, and that painting made a very big impression on me. It's a very large, supersized canvas that hangs in the Louvre by the French painter Jericho. And it depicts a group of people in states of severe distress, you know, on a raft abandoned on a sea. The first time it made a real impact on me, apart from seeing it as a visual work, was in a film I saw, and I'm very influenced by film, by cinematic presentations, called The Raft of the Medusa, or translated as that. It was a film from Slovenia I saw in the 1970s, so not long after I got going with radio feature making. And it concerned a group of fabulous artistic bohemians in Slovenia in the aftermath of the First World War, who were very much like the brave young Russian artists of the day, and I was very taken by them. They were abandoned by their society after being embraced for a little while. And I love this idea of this group of people who were artistic, who were for a moment, celebrated, and then they were cast adrift on this sea of indifference. So that had stuck in my mind over time as a powerful notion. And then when I wanted to make, I was reflecting very much on the disintegration of Yugoslavia throughout the early 1990s, and this image came to me again and again as something that was a very powerful symbol or representation of what was going on. And I wrote quite a bit of text, which is in the program, The Raft of the Medusa, which is very personal, which explored my own thinking about this imagery and imagery that came to mind there. And I had interviewed a most wonderful man, Alfred Boehm, who's an art historian in California, who was able to make a very dramatic interpretation of that painting that I was able to use to fit both the disintegration of Yugoslavia, but also the what was happening in Rwanda at the time, because I looked to art, again, to the community of artists to see what they were doing and saying and feeling about political events. And George Gittos, the Australian painter, was drawn into my program. He'd been an eyewitness to the events in Rwanda and had painted them, but had to stay outside of the conflict, as you do if you're an observer of that kind, and see these people, you know, cast adrift in this terrible situation. Would they survive or not? What would happen? And that same imagery, the imagery of this painting, The Raft of the Medusa, came very naturally to me in the aftermath of the Tampa affair, when we had the whole notion of asylum seekers being called very much into question. It was such a big issue in Australian politics and society. And so that image came to me again as a very powerful metaphor of what was happening. People were making journeys across seas on flimsy craft, as we know, on those awful boats that have been coming, and for many years before that, from Vietnam, from Asia, on flimsy boats trying to find sanctuary here. So it was a very powerful imagery for me to explore in On the Raft, All at Sea.
Mm. And art and artists always feature in your programs.
Absolutely. Because I was, yes, not only was I a young poet when I came to the ABC, but I was also very active in the Tin Sheds art community at Sydney University. I'd participated in quite a lot of performance artworks. I feel very close to the arts. I like the way artists and musicians think and arrange things. I think of myself as somebody who paints with sound, who composes things. These same approaches that I see in the arts and in music really are very appealing to me as means to find my way through words and sounds.
And it's always art exploring ideas.
Yes. Yes, whether it's something like, I made very explicitly a program called Starry Night, which was exploring that painting, that iconic painting by Van Gogh. And that was a lovely thing to do, but of course it was exploring more than that. It was really looking at notions of how do we transmit ideas and knowledge from one generation to another, from one part of the universe to the other. Also, writers interest me a great deal. I would have to say that on reflection, I've found that I've made a whole number of programs about writers who've meant a lot to me, like Bruce Chatwin, the Australian writer Charmian Clift, very, very powerful figure in my mind who I admire enormously.
Why?
Why? Because I think, for a start, she probably set me on the whole path that I then followed when, as a young kid, as a teenager, young maybe even younger than that, in Broken Hill, where I grew up, watching a newsreel and seeing footage of Charmian Clift and her husband, George Johnston, on the island of Idra in Greece, and their children, particularly young Martin Johnston, living a life that I immediately saw was one that I really aspired to or thought I did, which was the life of the artist, you know, unconstrained and travelling and spirited and, you know, intelligently inquiring of the world and responding and writing. I did discover by making a program about her that life was not quite as wonderful as all of that. That kind of lifestyle really had presented many difficulties for a brave and modern woman as she was. I later became friends with Martin, and, you know, we were young poets together, and I admired his work. So it meant something to me to make a program about her.
So tell me about sound and your relationship to sound in your work, and particularly sound as a kind of metaphor.
I think really the penny drop for me was I was making, this is in the late 70s, probably some little features. A lot of work I was doing with filmmakers at the time, as I say, I was very interested in their ideas, and I was finding that I was using their soundtracks and weaving them through fairly simple, you know, interview-based features. And then there was someone I was interviewing, it was Werner Herzog, and I couldn't get the soundtrack material. And I suddenly thought, well, what's in that? What would I need? And I found that I could get my hands on the constituent parts. I could find sounds of a jungle, you know, birds. I could find animals, monkeys. I could find music and various things and put it together in a way that created a fairly compelling world that you could enter. And I suppose that's what sound has allowed me to do, is to create, with the help of sound engineers who have been incredibly talented and great collaborators, to construct worlds that are both real and imagined by using sound. I think as a feature maker, the key to being one is really to be a good listener, to start to hear the world, to hear what's there in the sound world, so that you can isolate it and record it and bring it into the studio and maybe put things in different relations so that you become more aware of it. You can make a sound bigger, you can make a sound smaller, you can bring things together, and that's what I've enjoyed doing, bringing together sounds in a way to create, in a way, a composition, a musical frame in which things might sit. And the sound has also enabled my collaborators, to advance a narrative by not having to always say things. The sound can take you there in something like On the Raft, All at Sea. Using the sound, I mean, you don't always have to use sound literally, so that when Quang Lu, who is the man from Vietnam who was escaping in a little tiny craft, he was distressed, and I'm trying to think of his emotional state as he's, you know, cast adrift. And he thought they saw whales on the horizon. Sharks. You can imagine how this would all feel. So there's no real sound for sharks, but there is the most beautiful recording, or many recordings, of whales who sound so sad and haunting. So working those sounds into a sound picture enables you to sort of propel things and to make you feel things. Sound makes you feel.
Exactly. It's about creating a mood and
absolutely,
an emotion.
Absolutely, yes. Mm. Yes. So, you know, for me, a feature is creating a whole experience to engage you and to make you feel, so that you want to explore the ideas. I don't want to tell people how to think, or to have the people in the programs tell people how to think exactly, but to navigate a course through ideas and to have some space. Sound allows that space for you to think.
Now, as well as On a Raft, All at Sea, on the website, there's also a program called Left Wing. Tell me about that.
Well, there are several programs I have made for pleasure. And Left Wing is really a response to the fact that I'm left-handed and I find myself in a minority. And I've noted that there are, you know, other people who are left-handed, and I've begun to look at that. And so over time, I started to collect material around the notion that the left was interesting. And for this program, I explored, and I called it left wing because, you know, the hand is an extension of the body in a sense that a wing is. But tongue-in-cheek, it also explores left-wing politics, not necessarily through me, but through the wonderful character of Meredith Bergman, who is in that program, who has led a life as a committed left-wing politician. It explores the notion of left and right in cultures where the left is the evil side, the weak side, the dirty side. It looks at the left and the right in religion. It looks at the left bank of Paris as a beautiful place with a special sense of being against the right and, you know, sort of upper class conformity of the right bank of Paris. And it looked, I used as a device here, I had my palm read by a palm reader.
So you were quite brave to reveal a lot about yourself, perhaps stuff that you didn't even know.
Indeed, and I found it completely fascinating. I mean, I don't know that I believe it all, but it seemed to me a pretty interesting reading of who I was. One thing I feel about feature making, or about radio making, is you have to be prepared to, in a way, get down in the dirt. In a way, you have to be prepared to expose things, and sometimes they're about yourself and you don't, you know, I could definitely hide and edit material so that I present a better account of myself, but I thought that was very interesting that I'd been seen in that way, so that seemed a good thing to do.
And it's quite playful, and a lot of your work is playful.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, I enjoy that. Well, that's part of the engagement of the, you know, of the imagination. You know, I'm in a way imaginative. I want to engage through the imagination. I want to enchant people in some way and give them pleasure. And it also seems to me that, particularly with a subject like that, that in radio we have sometimes the opportunity to work in stereo, and that was an idea that was a sound idea. Left would also involve right. And so there was a spectrum from left to right, and we could play with that in sound. And I worked with, you know, very talented engineer Russell Stapleton, who was able to create, you know, great playful scenes across the sound spectrum that played with left and right. I also went to the left-handed shop. I interviewed a, you know, neuropsychologist and found things about the brain that were really interesting. And very intriguingly, when I was travelling in New York, I was able to attend a masterclass of a wonderful, celebrated pianist, Leon Fleischer, who at that stage was greatly afflicted by something like RSI or something else, and he played a repertoire for the left hand alone, and that was marvellous. So that brought music into the program in a very inventive way. And this led me to later make a wonderful feature, well, very intriguing feature for Into the Music, which exclusively looked at the world of left-handed music and musicians.
And that's where you spent the final part of your career as the executive producer of the music unit and the program Into the Music. What was it about that program that you enjoyed?
What I loved about it was really giving birth to it in a way. I mean, it was a program that came out of a need for music features, and it's a genre of its own that I've discovered needs special care and thought, and I've just loved being able to work on that and to make all sorts of discoveries about how you can and can't use music in programs, what music subjects lend themselves to a feature treatment. Sometimes they're a portrait, sometimes they're an investigation of a set of ideas, and it's just been a complete joy.
Another feature that people can hear on the website that they can download is The Graveyard Gate. That's an interesting program about a kind of, you know, gentle portrait of Rookwood Cemetery.
Mm. Well, it's about death, and it's about how we remember the dead. It's about how an artist sees the relationship between a place of burial and the place beyond, if there is one. The wonderful artist Hossein Valamanesh, who I had been following and including in my program since 1989. He has a particular sensibility, and he was invited to make a gateway for Rookwood Cemetery, and he did this enigmatic stairway to heaven, or to somewhere that you can't really get to. You can't get through the gate and onto it. And it led me to think about many things that interest me. In Rookwood Cemetery, we have the most harmonious city of the dead. We have people of every nationality living together, another one of my persistent themes, in great harmony. And we have this respect between the various cemetery authorities. Rookwood isn't just one cemetery, it's a set of trusts who look after each area, and they come together in the most beautiful way. I made it at a time of great upheaval in the arts at ABC in the 1990s, and I know I felt at that stage that I really would want to leave and go and work at Rookwood Cemetery. Such was my admiration for the people who worked there and the various trusts. It turned out that one of the characters I interviewed, Merv Manning, was a dancing partner of my mother as a young woman. She'd lived at Lidcombe, just near Rookwood Cemetery, so this was very pleasing to me. And he had the best stories to tell about the cemetery at night and all the sorts of shenanigans and charming things that happened there. The poet in me was grabbed by the epitaphs that are there. So brief, they're like haiku, and yet they contain a life story in a few words.
Mm. You've interviewed hundreds of people over these 35 years. Memorable moments?
Bruce Chatwin and Elizabeth Chatwin, so many years apart and with so many world experiences in the gap between them. Interviewing Bruce Chatwin with Stan Correy, my colleague here from ABC, who works on Background Briefing, and I went on the most amazing trip in early 1980 around the world. We made a series called Under the Skin of features, fairly plain features, but investigating nationalism and ethnicity. And we've got to meet Bruce Chatwin, and I can remember just feeling completely overawed and overwhelmed as a sort of an Australian with jet lag on their first trip overseas in the little tiny maid's room in this beautiful building in London where he lived, with his exotic treasures, and interviewing him about his writings on Argentina from his book In Patagonia. And then many years later, after his death, writing to Elizabeth Chatwin, his widow. Most people didn't think there was a woman in his life because
he was gay
and died of AIDS. But, this marvellous woman who'd been his partner, and I went to visit her at her invitation, at her rural house, and had the most wonderful interview with Elizabeth Chatwin, which I will always remember with great pleasure.
Mm. And what is it about interviewing people and receiving their story that you enjoy?
It's a gift, isn't it? It's an exchange that's really very special. In order to speak to them, I think, even if you have, and I always like to have a natural conversation, I don't like to go in with, other than maybe a piece of paper that is there as some sort of security blanket, but really everything must be internalised by then. And then you must listen, as I say, and it's this very special exchange. You're given this privilege of speaking to a person, and for some reason, whether it's because it's the ABC, which is a trustworthy source, or they like you, or some combination of both, And you've promised in some way, if you say it or not, that you're not going to treat what they do with disrespect, something opens up between you and you can have the most intense experience and exchange. I should say that in every way, whether it's in preparation for an interview of that kind, whether it's just engaging with a set of ideas, my whole approach has been to kind of immerse myself. For me, that notion of acting where a person is a method actor, and I don't mean to suggest that I'm acting in any way. Mm. I have lived everything I've done, as it were, so I've got into the ideas in a big way so that they then inhabit me, so that when I have then spoken with the person who I've thought about their ideas and read what they've written or seen what they've painted or whatever. You know somebody in a very special way. You're giving attention to someone that they don't always have.
And what reflections do you have about the role of the public broadcaster here in Australia in the cultural life of this country, having played a major part in that?
Well, I think it's really critical, you know, for someone like myself who grew up in a country town. It played such an important role in my life in presenting and giving me access to a world of ideas, a world of interpretation. I think the public broadcaster just has the opportunity to do so much more than the other sector, the private sector. I'm not suggesting that it's a sort of Reithian sense of nation building or holding together. It's about offering an opportunity, really, to people, offering access to worlds of ideas that are otherwise not available. We are today, with our activities, I think, in the digital domain, we're a sort of a cultural institution, but we're also a cultural filter, so that we're able to make sense of the world in a way, to be a kind of somewhere in between the world of chaos and making things a little bit more available. We have access to things in a way that people don't ordinarily, and in that privileged position of meeting people, as I've described, access to information and knowledge, there is sense in filtering that material and offering imaginatively things that are more... I always like radio as a speculation as well as an interpretation or an analysis. I think if you can't dream... And in order to dream, you've got to have some reference points. So if some dreamers can work here along with everybody else and point the way to a few stars or whatever, yeah.
Well, thank you, Robin, for coming in. We'll miss your dreams and your imaginings. It's been terrific to hear your ideas.
Thank you, and it's been such a pleasure to work here.